We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. The end of the Cold War brought a series of new questions about European security, including these. With the fall of the Soviet Union, was NATO still needed? Would European governments start to think more about their own security rather than collective security? Under what circumstances would European troops be deployed within Europe and beyond? In this hour of Focus, we'll try to take a look at some of these questions and talk about national defense policy in the European Union. Our guest for the program is Julian Howarth. He's professor of European politics and emeritus professor of European studies at University of Bath in the UK, and for a number of years now, since 2002, has been visiting professor of political science at Yale. He's published extensively on European politics and history, especially security and defense policy and transatlantic relations. He was visiting here on the campus a few weeks back at a conference sponsored by the European Union Center here at the University of Illinois, and it didn't work out for us to talk with him when he was here, but we thought it'd be interesting to have a conversation and talk a little bit about the issues that interest him, and he was good enough to say yes, he would spend some time with us. So he's joining us from Yale, and as we talk, questions are welcome. We just hope people can be brief and be on the topic, but of course, questions are welcome, and we'd like to get people involved in the conversation. If you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455 is the number. We have a toll-free line, so if it's long distance, use that one, 800-222-9455. And you can always send us an email, will-talk, W-I-L-L-talk, that's the address, at illinois.edu. And Professor Howarth, hello.
Hello.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us today.
My pleasure.
I hope that you wouldn't feel that it was too basic a place to start for me to ask a question, a basic question about the EU and about the first things, the most important things you would think that Americans should know. So I think that Americans, when they think about this this project of unification of Europe, they understand that now there's a common currency. I think they understand that what happened as a result of the unification is that it's easier for people and things to move around. But past that, I'm not sure, and they've of course heard stories about these contentious votes that have taken place that have to do with how people in various countries feel about the whole thing. But again, past all that, I'm not sure that they really understand what it all means. Is it actually possible to say the basic things that Americans should know about the EU?
Well, it's possible, yes. Going back to the beginning, I think there were two immediate stimuli after World War II. The first was internal. That was a desire on the part of the European Union, the European member states, to put an end to their 1,000-year-old civil war, which had brought the world to madness on many occasions, and to, you know, bury the hatchet and agree to get on. So it was a very powerful internal stimulus and a knowledge in Europe that unless the European states got together in the new bipolar world and multipolar world that was developing, they would count for very little. That's not balancing against America, but it is a desire to maximize their influence. But there was an external stimulus, which was the American desire to get the Europeans to get their act together, partly to prevent them from going back to war, but also to develop a unified market which would be beneficial to the United States. So the Marshall Plan was a major stimulus which had tremendous impact on the recovery of the European economies. And then, of course, the Cold War set in and you have a common external energy which is very galvanizing for internal unity. That was really the beginning of it. And it amounts to a voluntary pooling of sovereignty on the part of a number of sovereign states, something that had never happened in world history before, on key policy issues like, you know, trade, the single market. It is the case now that the 27 European Union member states speak with a single voice in the World Trade Organization, represented by the Commissioner for Trade. We now have, as you said, the single currency. Most member states are members of it. There are a couple of opt-outs. There's a single space called Schengen, so there are no borders anymore, no customs posts, no passports for the majority of the member states. There's a court, rather like the Supreme Court, because European Union law supersedes national law. That's a rather contentious issue, but that's in the treaty, and everybody knows that that's the case. And I think since the end of the Cold War, there's been a very important drive to develop a common foreign and security policy, which in 1999 produced a common attempt to develop security and defense instruments. Mm. And that's more or less where we are now.
Yeah.
The one final thing which I think is worth bearing in mind is that this has developed from six nations to 27, and enlargement is still an option in the future, where the European Union is talking to Turkey and a couple of other countries in the Balkans. So there's an awful lot going on. It's rather complicated and a little bit boring, actually, but that's what it is.
Hmm. Well, I guess my experience from just having dipped my toe into a little bit is I get very overwhelmed very quickly about the arcane details of the organization and its structure. Yeah. And who does what, and all of the various branches that are charged with particular kinds of functions. I guess I find myself thinking, though, again in reading about this, that there still seems to be a lot of unresolved tension, and maybe not surprising, between the idea of unification and what that means, and national sovereignty.
Mm-hmm.
Is that, and particularly in the minds of a lot of Europeans?
Well, I think it's less national sovereignty, although that is an issue in matters such as defense and currency and things like that. But it's more to do with identity. It's a question of whether or not European citizens are beginning to identify with this supranational organization, or whether they are, by very virtue of the fact that this has been created, a sort of ginormous unit all around them, whether they're not actually being encouraged to, you know, stress their more local identity, perhaps not even national identity. We have seen with the coming of the European Union a reassertion of regional identities and regional languages as a sort of attempt to hold on to something. So at the level of the ordinary citizen, I think that's the key issue.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, with immigration and the need for immigration, we're beginning to see the development of extreme right-wing parties which are opposed to the whole project.
Hmm. Well, it's not really surprising, is it, that we would have people who would be, rather than identifying as European, would identify as, let us say, Spanish, or maybe even further, not just identifying as Spanish, that identify as Basque.
Right.
No one really expected that that kind of thing was going to change, did they?
Well, a lot of people did, yes. Right. Founding fathers thought that very rapidly people would begin to identify with the European Union as such. That hasn't proved to be the case. These things take much longer than that to kick in. If you look at the way in which national identities were formed in the European nation states, in many cases it took 200-300 years for that national identity to consolidate. And it has to be, it has to be matched by the institutions. So we're a very long way from that for the moment. And I think, to be fair, I think that most European citizens are perfectly comfortable with the European Union. There aren't that many people, running around the streets screaming. And as long as the Union doesn't do things with which the majority of the people are fundamentally, to which they're fundamentally opposed, then, the view is, well, let it get on and do things. And there are a lot of polls which suggest that the majority of Europeans consider it entirely normal that there should be foreign and security policy should be done at European level rather than at national level. That's actually the one which is always top in the polls. Something like 75 to 80% of citizens, when asked, should foreign and security policy be done at national level or at European level, they think it's self-evident that it should be done at European level. So there's a big degree of contentment, which the media don't latch onto, and a small degree of ferocious discontent, which of course is the stuff of copy.
Hmm. Well, it strikes me that even when the Cold War was still on, when the enemy was the Soviet Union and the mission was collective defense, didn't they at that time weren't decisions essentially being made not on an individual level but on a much larger level? So in that sense, have things really changed?
Well, decisions on defense were essentially made through NATO. Most of the European member states had, in a sense, yielded their sovereignty to NATO, collective defense, back in 1949. It is the case that until sometime in the 1990s, there was no thought or no prospect whatsoever of the European Union taking on security and defense issues. That was done by NATO, and that was the end of the story. It was really only in the mid-1990s, when it became clear that, for historical reasons, the United States was beginning to disengage from Europe, certainly to disengage militarily. There's absolutely no reason why the man from Peoria should be paying his tax dollars to defend this country which is not threatened and which is becoming more wealthy than the United States. At that point, there's a big push from the United States to get the European member states to get their act together, if you like, particularly when things are happening like in the Balkans with the wars in former Yugoslavia. And that's the stimulus, really, for the Union taking on a defense and security remit.
Our guest in this hour, Julian Haworth, he's a professor of European politics and emeritus professor of European studies at University of Bath in the UK, and in the United States here since 2002, has been visiting professor of political science at Yale. His field of study, European politics and history. Questions welcome as we talk here about the EU and about European security. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Well, how do people now in Europe, now again, since we're well into the post-Cold War period and the concern is no longer collective defense against the potential attack by the Soviet Union, how do people think about what the mission is? What are they securing themselves against?
Well, I suppose one has to be honest here and say that for the majority of overwhelming majority of European citizens, once the Cold War ended, what they were interested in was the peace dividend. Mm. So they don't think in terms of the need for large military expenditures or outlays of that type. What has become clear to those who are responsible for thinking through security and defense issues is that the entire perimeter of the European Union, the entire border now, if you go from the Baltic states in the north, which have sort of problems with resurgent Russia, all the way down that problematic border with Belarus and into the Black Sea area with Georgia, Ukraine, all of that, and then down through the Middle East and along the North African coast, the entire border of the entire European Union is a series of crises waiting to happen, and they have been happening at an alarming rate. So the EU has felt a very strong need, at least the leaders, decision makers, felt a very strong need to develop capacity, to develop institutions which will allow them to take political decisions and to decide on when to intervene in a crisis. Now, the first big example, obviously, was the Balkans, which is often regarded as an external to the European Union. But if you look at a map, those Balkan countries are completely surrounded by the European Union, Greece to the south, Italy to the west, and then, Austria and Hungary and whatnot to the north. So they are inside, physically and geographically, inside the Union. It was not possible to contemplate the idea of genocide taking place within the confines of the European Union. So that was the big stimulus to get military capacity together and to develop an institutional mechanism which would allow the leaders of the European countries to take decisions on intervention. And they intervened quite a lot in the Balkan countries. They've intervened repeatedly in Africa to stop crises there, And they have these crisis management missions dotted all around the southeast into the Palestinian Authority, where there are a couple of missions there, and even as far afield as Indonesia. The big one at the moment, of course, is the anti-piracy mission off the coast of Somalia. So there's a lot going on. And, of course, with these developments in North Africa, the big question which has arisen is, should the European Union as such take on the responsibility for managing these crises, or is it not ready once again, just like it wasn't ready when the Balkans blew up in the 1990s?
Mm. We have a caller here to bring into the conversation, somebody who's in Mahomet, a nearby community. We'll go there. Line number one. Hello.
Yes. I have 2 points I'd like to make. I have followed this on the EU for a very long time through the BBC. And it was my impression, a very strong impression, that the whole purpose of the EU was to become as big an economy as the U.S. and become even bigger if possible, and that was the whole purpose of combining. And the second thing is that we should no longer be running NATO, but the EU has refused to pick up the major share of that responsibility because it is no longer the U.S.'s responsibility now that the Cold War is over, and that the NATO partners have just refused to step up. Please comment.
Okay. On the economy, I think from the very beginning, it was recognized both in the U.S. and in Europe that the bigger the better. The bigger the better because this would be a mutually penetrable market. This would produce growth. It would produce jobs. It would, you know, stimulate industry. And that was explicit in the terms of the Marshall Plan. There's a sentence in there which says that we actually want Europe to pick itself up to such a state that it will become a competitor for America, because we believe in competition, and the bigger the competitor, the better. So this is a positive sum game. Everybody gains from having as big an economy as possible. So it's not really a threat to the United States in any way.
I didn't think, the bigger, the better. I mean, the whole purpose of the EU was to X us out if possible.
Oh, no. The American investment in the EU is bigger than American investment anywhere else in the world. The American investment in the Netherlands is bigger than all American investment in China at the moment. So it's seen, and they are, each is the other's biggest trading partner, biggest investment partner, and so on and so forth. That is very much a partnership. But on NATO, I agree with you entirely. After the end of the Cold War, the Europeans should have picked up the baton. And logically, like all alliances through history, once the enemy against which the alliance was designed in the first place has disappeared, the alliance tends to dissolve. That has not happened here, partly because of habit. NATO has become a big organization, a big institution, and they don't sort of commit harakiri and close up shop overnight. And partly also, you're absolutely right, because the European member states, for the most part, have become lazy. They've become lazy and they've become free riders, and they're used to that. And they're not happy to contemplate spending a much larger share of their resources on defense. And as long as the United States is prepared to pick up the slack, these countries think that that's perfectly fine. I think, and I think this is implicit in your question, that's creating a structural crisis within the transatlantic relationship. And that is absolutely true.
Thank you so much.
All right, thank you. Well, I would expect that there are people in Europe who would say the problem now with NATO is that it was an organization that existed for the defense of Europe, and, of course, the big player was the United States. When the threat of the Soviet Union was gone, then NATO became something that was more of an organization that existed to further the foreign policy goals of the United States, and that the United States government and successive United States governments have expected the Europeans to follow along. And I can imagine some Europeans saying that that they're not interested in doing that. That's not what NATO was supposed to be for, and that's not something they want to be doing now.
That is absolutely right. Throughout the 90s, in the decade after the end of the Cold War, the pressure from the United States to transform NATO, lock, stock and barrel, was immense. And the proposal was that NATO should become a global alliance, which essentially means that the Europeans will help out in American grand strategy, if you like. And the Europeans resisted that. Even the Brits resisted massively transforming the alliance into something that was never intended to be. That happens for a brief moment in time at the Prague summit of NATO in September 2002. After 9/11 and before the invasion of Iraq, nobody wants to rock the boat, and everybody goes along with a decision to turn NATO into a global alliance. It's actually in the summit communique. What that means is that an alliance which, as you say, was initially configured to guarantee American support for European security is effectively turned on its head and becomes an alliance designed to guarantee European support for American global strategy. And that is something which the Europeans signed up to at Prague, but in their deepest internal selves just don't want to do and don't feel they're capable of doing and are very reluctant. There is a small number of European states which are expeditionary-minded. The Brits come to mind, obviously, the French, the Dutch, the Danes. But that's about it. And the others really see NATO in its traditional guise as a defense against the Soviet Union, which no longer exists. There are many different versions within the European member states as to what NATO is actually for. And we keep going round and round in circles with this debate. What is the alliance for?
This gets to the issue of grand strategy, and I know this is something that you have written about. I suppose that the United States does have a grand strategy, although if you walked around Washington, you'd probably get a lot of different ideas about what it was, but we seem to have one. And I think that that what you've argued for is that, in fact, Europe needs one and doesn't have one.
Right.
I suppose the two questions would be, well, why is it important to have a grand strategy, and what would a shape of one look like?
Well, it's important to have one because at the end of the day, a grand strategy is a very simple thing. It is a clear idea of what it is you're trying to achieve in the world, what you're trying to accomplish. And although the European Union has declared that it has a common foreign and security policy, nobody has ever sat down and tried to figure out quite what that means. And if it is aspiring to be or purporting to be an actor on the global stage, which all of the documentation suggests it is, then it's really absolutely essential to establish priorities, to have a very clear idea of what you're attempting to achieve. You know, what sort of a world is it that Europe wants to try and contribute to making out there? Now, we haven't really had that debate in those terms. And that's partly because the institutions that have been created in the last 10 years have really been about reacting to crises rather than being proactive in looking forward and trying to shape the world in a sort of proactive manner. You know, just take the crises across North Africa at the moment. These were crises which were perfectly possible to foresee. At any rate, it was perfectly possible to foresee that the status quo couldn't go on forever. But instead of actually trying to do something serious about it, the European Union set up this thing called the Union for the Mediterranean, which was a French presidential Sarkozy's pet project, which effectively did very little. It certainly didn't address any of these issues. So the EU really needs to have something like the National Security Council, where there are informed people who are sitting down, looking at the world, and trying to decide where the EU can be effective in bringing about positive change. And it's probably completely utopian to assume that the EU can be a global actor in the way in which the United States has been for the last 40, 50, 60 years. Even the United States today cannot do that. So they have to make choices, and it's those choices which for the moment are lacking.
Well, you talked about the fact that after the, when we getting into the post-Cold War period, really the first sort of security crisis that the Europeans saw and involved themselves in was the conflict in the Balkans.
Yeah.
And with good reason, people would still have been able to remember, maybe some people would remember, certainly if they read their history, they knew that it was a conflict in the Balkans that touched off the First World War. So in the interest of stability, which ultimately is in the interest of security, you'd want to prevent things from getting out of hand. So perfectly natural that they would want to do that, and everybody would agree that would be important. But when you start getting further and further away from Europe, I imagine there are more and more people ask questions about, well, in what way is it in our security interest, for example, to be going after pirates in the waters off of Africa, or for that matter, do we get involved in a civil war in North Africa? In what extent? Mm-hmm. To what extent is that in our interest in terms of our security?
Those are very good questions. I think there are answers to those questions. As far as involvement in sub-Saharan Africa, because most of the initial missions which the European Union took on from 2003 onwards were four or five missions in Congo. Congo has been involved in an uninterrupted civil war for decades, and more people have died in Congo than died in the whole of Second World War, sort of European statistics anyway. So there was a very clear reason for doing that, because the demographic drive of immigrants north from sub-Saharan Africa is very strong indeed, and is going to get even stronger, in that the population of Africa as a whole, and particularly sub-Saharan Africa, is going to double in the next 25 years. So the pressures, the migratory pressures north into Europe, are such that it is in Europe's vital interest, absolutely in Europe's vital interest, to try to stabilize the whole of the African continent. And that was what some of those missions was about. But the pirate mission is an interesting one, in that in the initial stages, it was really a question of trying to swap these small pirate boats, you know, one by one, by sending out naval forces to do so. But in the process, probably in the course of the first year of that mission, it became clear that what was at issue here is the sea lanes, tremendously important commercial sea lanes between the Suez Canal, which brings stuff all the way through from Europe, the Suez Canal to Shanghai. And that goes through that coast off Somalia, and it goes through the Straits of Malacca, where there are also pirates. So this is the first time when the European Union really begins to see a strategic mission. This is vitally important way into the distant future, to keep those sea lanes open, because something like 64% of all EU trade goes through those coastal waters. And that has become the mission now, and is very clear.
The guest in this hour of Focus, Julian Howarth, is visiting professor of political science at Yale. He's an expert on the field of European politics and history. We're talking about the European Union and security issues in Europe. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Focus.
Could you get on the bus? On Thursday, April 28th from 7 and 9 p.m. at NCSA Auditorium on the U of I campus, join us for an interactive evening of inspiration and conversation featuring clips from Freedom Riders, an American Experience film event. Get the opportunity to discuss with WILL what you'd get on the bus for today. For more information, visit willconnect.org. That's Thursday, April 28th from 7 and 9 p.m.
WILL programs are made possible by Strawberry Fields Natural Food Store, offering more than 3,000 certified organic products, freshly baked breads, a coffee bar and bulk foods department, and an in-store nutritionist to answer questions about healthy eating. Strawberry Fields on Springfield Avenue in Urbana.
This is Focus. I'm David Inge. We're here weekday mornings with 10 topics for you every week. Coming up in hour two, we'll talk with David Weinberger. He's a senior researcher at the Berkman Center at Harvard University. We'll talk about knowledge in the age of social media. Tomorrow morning at 10, Joel Brinkley is the guest. He's a journalist. We'll talk about his recent book, Cambodia's Curse, The Modern History of a Troubled Land. And we'll finish up the week talking about new cars. Maybe you're thinking about bringing a new car into your family. Our guest will be Mike Quincy. He's an auto content specialist with Consumer Reports. Every year now for a long time in the spring, they put out an issue rating the best and worst of new cars. And we'll talk about that tomorrow morning at 11. You can listen online at WILL.illinois.edu. If you missed any of this morning's program, you can catch up. You can also go back and listen to past shows. Again, that website is WILL.illinois.edu. Julian Howarth is the guest in this hour of the show. He is professor of European politics and emeritus professor of European studies at the University of Bath in the UK. He's visiting professor of political science at Yale, has been since 2002. He's done a lot of writing on European politics and history, especially security and defense policy and transatlantic relations. He was here visiting the campus a few weeks ago. Took part in a conference sponsored by the European Union Center. We weren't able to have him here then, but we thought it would still be worth spending a little time talking about some of the things that he talked about when he was here, and he was very good to give us some of his time today. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And if you would like to send us an email, you can participate in the program that way. And the address is will-talk, that's W-I-L-L-talk, at illinois.edu. Again, perhaps not surprising that within Europe, the largest countries, the most influential countries, are going to be the ones that I'm sure will drive the conversation about security. And the three biggest, of course, would be the UK and France and Britain. France and Germany. Yes. UK, France, Germany. Has there been an opportunity, have these governments taken the opportunity to let us say, advance personal projects and use the larger EU structure to help them advance those projects?
When you say personal projects, what do you mean?
Well, I'm thinking of national projects. I mean that. Well, I guess I'm thinking personal projects in the sense that a national leader would undertake them, but that they would in fact be national projects. Yes.
Yeah, there's been a tremendous tension about this from the very beginning. As I said earlier, up until the turn of the century, 1999-2000. The European Union didn't do security and defense at all. And this was largely because the United Kingdom, as the biggest military power in Europe, and as the most Atlanticist, that is to say the most committed to the United States, simply wouldn't allow discussion of security matters inside the European Union. It had to go through NATO. It was only when the Americans began to put pressure on the British that they decided that the price of keeping NATO was for the Europeans to actually do something about getting their own military act together. Mm-hmm. So there was a British push for this for essentially Atlanticist reasons, if you like. Now, the French were pushing for the same thing, but because the French had always believed in developing Europe into a major world power, put it simply, that's been a French dream ever since General de Gaulle. So the objective converges, but the reasons why they're doing this are slightly divergent. Germany is a completely different picture because Germany, ever since World War II, has resisted militarism in any form. There's a culture which has set in very, very deeply now that fighting and soldiers are bad things, that we shouldn't be doing this sort of thing, that Europe is a soft power, Europe is a warm, fuzzy power and leads through example. So there's a serious divergence mm-hmm. between the motivations and the background thinking of these three major powers. However, they've all agreed on embarking on these various missions that the European Union has been involved in, especially since these are still, to some extent, as in NATO, in fact, coalitions of the willing. So if it's a question of getting a group of countries together to send an expeditionary force into Chad to protect refugee camps for the Darfur refugees, hundreds of thousands of them fleeing into Chad, then you get together a number of countries that are prepared to do that. And we can see the same with every one of these missions. So to date, there's been a relative degree of consensus about the sorts of missions that the European Union could undertake. What's come adrift in this recent Libyan example is that there is no consensus on it at all.
What are they thinking of in terms of this this business of soft power? It seems that it's something that is getting more discussion, at least to some extent, here in the United States, about how a nation projects power. And of course, I suppose always the champion of soft power is China. That's the example that's offered. And others say here in the United States, or perhaps other places, would say we could learn something from the Chinese. In Europe, how do they think about this breakdown, hard versus soft power? And are there a lot of people making this argument that actually more kind of effort and resources should go into a projection of soft power?
It's a debate. It's a very lively debate, not only among politicians and practitioners, but also among academics. The notion that Europe can exist and can influence the course of world history simply as a soft power is quite well developed. They call it normative power Europe. It's the proposition that Europe, because it has buried its own internal hatchets, its member states have agreed to cooperate with one another, even though there may be policy differences between states, that it resolves its differences through bargaining and institutional arrangements and so on, and that Europe has developed a very, what should we say, generous policy of development aid to the global south and so on and so forth. Europe has succeeded, and there's no doubt about this, this is a fact, Europe has succeeded in democratizing a whole raft of countries which were formerly dictatorships: Greece, Spain, Portugal, all of those communist countries from the former Warsaw Pact, which are now members of the European Union and which have embraced market forces and democracy as the price of becoming members. So in all those aspects, there is a sense that the European Union is seen in the rest of the world as a sort of model of how to do international relations differently, not sending gunboats, not sending expeditionary forces to impose will, but doing things differently and emerging as a kind of exemplar. Now, there is also a very large category of analysts which think that is a myth, and certainly the evidence from around the world. If you ask Chinese or Indians or Brazilians or Africans, or particularly places where Europe had colonies and empires and whatnot, they don't quite see Europe in such a benign light, and they certainly don't see it necessarily as an example. So the argument there is that if Europe is to actually be successful in stabilizing turbulent parts of the world, and particularly turbulent parts of its own near abroad, its own neighborhood, it has to have some modicum of military force and a clear idea of what it's going to do with that. Mm. So, yeah, there really is a debate between those who think that Europe can do all this through soft power alone and those who think that the only way that your soft power is actually going to be effective is if you have the hard power to make it deliverable. Mm.
It seems that when you talk about the extension of hard power, and again, going back to, well, what is the mission, what's the crisis, that at least now, since the Cold War ended, what we're talking about basically is putting out small fires before they grow into big ones.
Absolutely.
Having said that, though, do people in Europe, do they really worry about, is there still some worry that they have about Russia? And the idea that we could be looking at something like that conflict that we, for such a long time, were preparing for that fortunately never came.
You can probably divide the 27 European member states into three camps on this. Those who have a border with Russia, or those who were formerly part of the Soviet Union, that is the three Baltic states, those that were formerly part of the Warsaw Pact involuntarily, so we're thinking of Poland and the Czech Republic to some extent, those countries have had a very conflictual relationship with Russia and still fear Russia to a very large extent. There's no question. I mean, they've been through 50 years of totalitarian hell, and you can fully understand their nervousness when they think about, you know, what Russia may develop into in the future. And they have, particularly since they joined the European Union, in many ways delighted in poking the Russian bear in the eye whenever they've been able to. The other extreme of that, many of the Western European countries which are dependent on Russian oil and gas, totally dependent or very, very largely dependent, and who would essentially sell their soul for a barrel full of oil. And they make the two outriders, if you like. And there's a middle group of countries which try to marry principle and pragmatism and come up with some sort of partnership arrangement with Russia. Now, I think that we're probably seeing now a convergence of the two extremes on that middle position, because the former communist countries have learned that they achieve actually nothing by poking the Russian bear in the eye. They just make matters worse, and they're beginning to rethink some of their sort of aggressive tactics towards the Soviet Union. And those countries that are prepared to sell their soul for a barrel full of oil, as I put it, mm-hmm. have become very concerned about the development of democracy in Russia and the way, you know, freedom of the press and all of that is stifled. And so they too are really converging on this middle position. Now, I think it's absolutely essential for the European Union to develop a strategic partnership with Russia. They are, to a very large extent, two huge entities which are mutually dependent. Russia is dependent on the European Union to a very large extent to buy all its oil and gas and to invest in infrastructure which it desperately needs. And the European Union is dependent on Russia for the supply of oil and gas. So there's an obvious sort of partnership potential there, which is completely different from the United States' relationship with Russia. Mm-hmm. And I would say even that probably getting Russia right is arguably the European Union's first priority in foreign affairs. Hmm.
Well, you know, right after the Cold War, a number of nations, some of them that had been, perhaps all of the new members that came into NATO after the Cold War, were nations that had been in the Soviet sphere. And this was in part, I think, the result of a deliberate effort by the United States to pursue NATO enlargement, and perhaps it also was in the manner of speaking, sticking the finger in the eye of the Russians. It made the Russians very angry, complicated mm-hmm. the relationship between the United States and Russia. Now it seems that for these countries that were joining, they were interested in moving away from Russia, allying themselves with the West, and that seemed to be the avenue that was open to them. And I think at the time, a lot of people said, well, what really is this? It's an attempt to get into the EU by the back door. Assuming that was the case then, are there now four countries like that, countries like Hungary and Poland and the Baltic states and whoever else to actually get involved in this European project? So the idea of NATO membership maybe doesn't mean what it had once.
I think that's absolutely right. When they first emerged from the yoke of the Soviet Union, the one thing they were all desperate for was NATO membership, and they were very explicit about this. They wanted Article 5 protection, which says that an attack on any of them is an attack on all of us, and that was what, you know, America was prized for. What they didn't realize was that NATO membership meant that they were going to have to send troops to Afghanistan and possibly to Libya and places that, and Africa, places that they didn't particularly have any interest in being involved in. And so they've begun to rethink that. In parallel, membership of the European Union, which was much, much more difficult to achieve than membership of NATO. I mean, membership of NATO, effectively, you sign on the dotted line at the bottom of the application form. Mm-hmm. But membership of the European Union involves really serious changes and reforms. But they are now members of the European Union, and they have begun to realize that there are tremendous advantages to membership. And so the balance of their priorities as between NATO and the EU has shifted, probably, I would say, now in favor of the EU. And we're seeing that in Poland in particular, which is a very large country. Poland has begun to take the EU much, much more seriously than it did shortly after it emerged from the Soviet sphere.
Maybe 5-6 minutes left in this part of Focus with Julian Haworth. He's now visiting professor of political science at Yale, emeritus professor of European studies at University of Bath, UK. We're talking about European politics and security issues. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. You can also email us at well-talk@illinois.edu. I don't know if this question is too far afield from the kind of things that you're interested in, but I'll ask. What now in Europe are people thinking about Turkey and the possibility of bringing Turkey in?
Well, this is the big unanswered question. On which there are just about as many opinions as there are, you know, citizens almost. Mm. Boiled down to its basics, there's a resistance to Turkish membership in almost all EU member states for one reason or another, either because it's a huge country with a huge population, would become immediately the biggest country, even bigger than Germany, or it's a very poor country with a huge agricultural base, which would cause massive competition with European agriculture. Or, and this is the one that you're not supposed to talk about, that it's a Muslim country, which is perceived as posing some sort of a problem. Taken from another perspective, you could say that if Europe is in the business of doing security and defense policy, it needs to learn to run before learn to walk before it runs. And an EU which embraced Turkey and went halfway into Central Asia would immediately become responsible for stability and security in some of the most volatile parts of the world. So there's a resistance there. There are national resistances as well, and the French and the Austrians have made it quite clear that they will organize a referendum of their citizens, and all of the opinion polls suggest that the referendum would be lost massively. So there's a huge problem for Turkey as well in engaging in these negotiations, because it may take 10, 15 years to go through the negotiations, at the end of which a single vote in a single country could deny Turkey the membership that it wants. So it's a massively complicated and controversial issue. And I think that the Turks themselves are beginning to become a bit jaundiced with it. There are so many more obstacles in policy areas that have not yet been resolved, not yet been, not even started negotiating about them. And the development that Turkey is currently going through suggests that it's beginning to have second thoughts about whether it really wants to have full membership of the European Union. So there is this alternative of having what's called a privileged partnership or a privileged relationship, whereby Turkey could be part of many of the policy areas but not a full member. It's going to be at least another 10, probably 15 and 20 years before any of this is resolved. Mm.
It certainly seemed that it didn't. There was this very initial bloom of excitement and enthusiasm, I think, on both in among people in Turkey and in Europe, but it seemed that didn't last very long.
Right. I think that's right. It hasn't lasted. Both sides are having second thoughts about it. I don't think that's putting it too strongly. The American push and pressure on the European Union to admit Turkey has actually been counterproductive. There's been endless, relentless pressure from Washington on the European Union, particularly those countries which are resisting, to admit and accept Turkey. And that pressure itself, I think, has actually had the opposite effect.
Well, what in what way is it in the interest of the United States to have Turkey in the EU?
Well, in the same way as it was in the interest of the United States after World War II to create a unified Europe, it's in the interest of the United States to have sort of identical memberships in both NATO and the European Union. So the larger the larger the unit, the greater the collective influence which the United States can exert within that unit. I think that's as simple as that.
Just now, we're coming down to maybe we have about a minute or so to maybe one final question. This is a big question, but you know, to what extent do cultural issues really complicate the whole matter of European Union?
I don't think they do. It's a generational thing here. Students, young people, travel, move about, speak languages, are excited by multiculturalism, excited to participate in a union which has such a wide diversity of cultures. So I think that that's something which, as each generation passes on, will become less and less important. Obviously, each of those member states is attached to its own culture and its own language, but those are not under threat. Nobody's suggesting that we have a unified culture or a unified language.
And do younger people, we talked a little bit earlier about this issue of how people define themselves and about the fact that in the post-war unified era that in fact people, the idea of identity and national identity seemed to even become, in a sometimes very limited sense, seemed to become even more important. Do younger people, do they have this tendency to think of themselves as Europeans, or do they identify in a more localized way?
Well, you know, everybody has a double identity. So it is the case, I think, that when you ask, when asked the question, do you identify as a European, older people would not even understand the question. The younger people increasingly say that they can identify as European, but they also identify as French, German, Polish, or whatever. That's something which is evolving over time. The big question is whether a European identity will ever transcend and replace the primary identity which remains national.
Our guest for this hour has been Julian Haworth. He's professor of European politics and emeritus professor of European studies at University of Bath in the UK. He, since 2002, has been visiting professor of political science at Yale, has written a lot about European politics and history. And Professor Haworth, thanks very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Also, we'd like to thank the technical director, Doug Forbush, who is on the other end of this high-quality connection we have between here and Yale.